Tonight, I've been asked to give a few words about energy, and I'd like to share with you some of my concerns about energy. My credentials are not overly impressive in this area, although I spent 15 years, almost 16 years of my life with General Electric Company at the Hanford Atomic Products Operation as a scientist in looking at the biological effects of irradiation in animals for application to people. Our concentration was in the area of the low-level effects of radiation. Unlike most agencies, the Atomic Energy Commission chose to invest rather substantial amounts of money to define the potential hazards of their industry. And as a result of this very extensive research, not only looking on short-term studies, but very long-term studies, they have arrived at a place and are still continuing now under the HERDA agency, the Energy Research and Development Administration, or agency. But they have, at this point, defined their potential hazards better than any other industry. And as an industry, it probably has a better safety record than any other. And this has come about in great part by the very extensive research that has been done. Some of the studies that I've been involved in have involved a lifetime of long-term animals. In some of our studies in sheep, we gave radioactive material for not the ordinary lifetime of sheep, but extending out to 11 years. And that's a very old sheep. One study that I initiated in 1950 was concluded in 1965. And so they are very involved studies at the University of California in over 1,000 dogs in one experiment on low-level effects, still continuing. And so this is the nature of my involvement, and in addition to my regular studies in the area of radiation biology, physiology, I've also had a study in nuclear engineering and associated matters at the General Electric School of Nuclear Engineering. And these activities have taken me out of the grandstand into the playing field on occasion. Most recently, I was invited to by the Swedish government to address there, along with a Frenchman, a fellow from the Netherlands, and Swedish scientists, the area of the long-term and late effects of irradiation, since about the only way Sweden to remain a viable entity is the nation it is, energy-wise, is to go nuclear. And I have great concerns relative to the energy situation. And I'd like to share with you just a few of these concerns now. And because more than most, it's plagued by false prophets. People who make a lot of noise and like a lot of noise, the emptier the drum, the louder the noise. That's one of my laws. I'll give you a few illustrations of this. As far as I'm concerned, nuclear energy has not had a fair shake from the press, and I'm also concerned in the whole area of energy conservation. Recently, I was in Alaska, and I was, among other places, out on the Kenai, and I talked to some engineers on the Prudhoe Bay project and on the pipeline, and I asked them how things were going and whether their predictions were correct relative to so far as the amount of oil that they might find. And it's a chancy game, but they didn't think it would be probably as much as they first thought. And that brings me to one of my greatest concerns, and that is in the whole area of our hydrocarbon fuel supply. When I drove here from Pullman to 25 Mile Creek, I drove in my old 62 Fury. It's got almost a new motor, and we're on our second 100,000 miles by now. And I drive about 53 to 58 miles an hour. And I was passed by most everything on the road, including very large trucks. About a year ago or so, the United States initiated an agency directed towards the saving of energy. I guess there was 18 or 20 nations involved in it. And it was a great idea. They were going to organize to see the various ways and exchange ideas on how they might conserve energy, especially oil. I don't know if you know what the recent results are now after a year of how things went. Several of the countries who are using far less oil than us per capita, and I don't know anybody that uses more, but many of them, Italy and many of these other countries, who joined with us in this adventure of saving fuel, they have made some very remarkable progress. What about the United States? We are using the same amount of oil now as we did when we joined this, and when we initiated this enterprise of saving fuel. We are 13th in this particular race. All these other ones who have been using less oil than us really saved it, and we didn't. And this concerns me very much, because we just cannot continue the way we are. In my trip in February to the Scandinavian countries in Scotland, I found out the Norwegians, who are sort of the Arabs of the north, they on visiting here are shocked with all the fuel we waste. Water skiing and burning gas on these high-powered boats, on these high-powered race cars, and we just can't keep going that way. There's no way. And keep getting, you know, building big cars, and doing very little about mass transit. The well is getting empty. And then a lot of people say, well, let's go to coal. Well, coal, we have a reserve that's very substantial. But as one looks at energy, you have to look at it on the basis of societal cost. What is the cost to society economically? And if you're going to go to coal, and I think we have to go to coal, what is the hazard of coal? You have to examine that. And you can't tear up the ground and leave it all torn up. You've got to leave it in better shape than we've been leaving it. That also costs you and I money. And in this regard, you have to look at the hazard, the biological hazard of it. And as I told the Swedish press when they came in to interview us, and they asked me what I was doing there, and I said I was there because I was invited, and I was welcoming any opportunity to ask the press for a fair shake. And at this point in time, the Swedes were very shook up about the hazards of nuclear energy. They felt they should stay with hydrocarbon fuel or some other source. Now, if one examines this, and I told them, for I knew that they had had a recent news release in their press about a spill of tritium, which is radioactive hydrogen. It was an insignificant spill, an insignificant amount that represented no biological hazard. Tritium happens to be one of it has a permissible limit that's higher than almost any other radioactive isotope. Yet, for the Swedes, this made the headlines, and the person who reported this, who was working in a nuclear plant, was awarded by the press the story of the month. And I asked the press if they had ever published as headlines that between 15,000 and 20,000 people lost their lives last year in the coal industry. That's people dead. Obviously they had not. You won't find this on the headlines of the paper. If there was a radiation incident involving just a spill without even an accident, it makes headlines. They don't mind if you lose lives with hydrocarbon fuels or with any other, but you better not do it with radiation because that's different. You have to operate nuclear plants without risk. There is nothing else in life that operates without risk. I am not saying that nuclear energy, for example, operates without risk. But for me, I would much prefer a nuclear plant in my backyard than the present coal-burning plants. If one examines the permissible limits of, say, radiation, compared with sulfur dioxide, which is only one of the effluent agents from burning hydrocarbon fuel, you will come to realize the difference between the amount of radiation predicted from all the nuclear plants in the year 2000, that is the radiation exposure to the people of this country, is about a million times less than a dose that would cause a death to half of an exposed population. If you take on the same chart as I did for the Swedes, and you compare where the present exposures are for just SO2, sulfur dioxide, not including carbon monoxide, not including particulate material, and that makes a lot of difference on toxicity, or including the oxides of nitrogen, which are also hazardous. Unfortunately, most of these hazards are not defined as radiation has been defined. But the ambient levels noted in many cities are higher than those that cause damage to people. They're higher than the standards set in many cities. And they're only two or three factors below what will cause serious damage to animals. We know that in an inversion condition in London in 1952, with the coal dust they had, it caused an excess death rate, or death, of over 4,000 in the period of a few months. And if you can't understand the difference between a twofold or a fourfold, between 100 and 100,000, then you got a problem. And many people have this problem. A nader who knows nothing about nuclear energy is one of the loudest voices present today to say that you should stop all nuclear plant development. It doesn't make me a nickel whether you put in nuclear plants or not, personally. But I am concerned about societal costs. And Nader would say, you don't have to go to nuclear, You can go to solar or to fusion. And now some people have laughed at him about this. One group told him, you know, you're out of your tree in Los Angeles. So he changed his story by the time he got to Salt Lake City. But he was back on the same story by the time he got to Washington. And because when you're in his kind of a situation, how do you make your money? This is my accusation now. Well, you make a lot of your money on lecture tour, don't you? I don't know what his fees are, probably $2,500 a throw, maybe sometimes less. But you got to keep the people stirred up. It doesn't have to be true, but it's got to be terror, because terror sells. Now, relative to solar, I believe that there's some potential in solar. We're going to do an experiment here, and it might even do us some good here. Our scientific committee is looking at this, and we're going to be testing it out. Maybe we can get some help from the sun. I think quite a bit of it will be used in heating buildings. I think there's a lot that can be developed, but it takes research to do it. And if you're going to think you're going to get a lot of help from solar that's going to really relieve our energy demands over the next few decades, well, that's very significant. I have a hard time believing that. By the same token, he says, well, why don't we go to fusion? We got to have many quantum jumps in our technology before we have fusion operating. We're not even sure we're going to make it go with that. It promises. I remember when I was at the 4th International Peacetime Congress of the Peacetime Uses of Nuclear Energy in Geneva, Switzerland. It was a great meeting, 1971. And all the big wheels in the business were there expounding on, among other things, the various sources of energy in the nuclear field. And the outstanding Russian in this field, and Russia is doing a very great deal in fusion energy, said it's not a matter of if, it's when. And that depends on how much money you give us. There were others that weren't too sure about that.
What is fusion?
Well, fusion is really building a miniature sun. That's a good job. You see, when you talk about nuclear energy, there are three that are generally under consideration. And the one of the atomic bomb is based on the principle that there are certain elements that on fissioning, that is splitting in half, they are exothermic, that is, they give off a lot of energy. Two of these are uranium-235 and plutonium. Plutonium is man-made. Uranium-235 is natural. And if you put them in a certain configuration that's called a critical mass, then you can get power out of them. You can control it, in a fission plant you can control it by certain methods, which I won't go into, and the fuel you use is different from what you use in an atomic bomb. The material in an atomic bomb has to be what we call bomb-grade material. And you don't use that in a power plant. You can't take the fuel out of a power plant and construct an atomic bomb in your basement. You have to have rather remarkable chemical separation plant to separate out the plutonium and then get bomb-grade material. So that's fission, and you have, of course, a fantastic amount of power from this, the real active portion of the bomb, for example, at Hiroshima, wasn't very big, yet it really blew the place apart. A cube of it is probably equivalent to 13 tons of coal or something. Fantastic. Or not very big hunk burned would supply the city of Chelan for a couple of weeks, I imagine. So there's a lot of punch in it, huh? Packs a lot of punch. Now, a development in the late 40s and 50s was that of the breeder reactor. And this was a development, again, in the fission area, where you utilize plutonium as a fuel, and you end up making more plutonium than you use up. And that's why it's called a breeder reactor, and they worked out some of the technology, and that is under big fire today. There are those who say that it's going to be really great. There are some test ones going now. And others say it's a demon. And it's a liquid metal cooling, And then some people think you ought to go to an air-cooled system. But this is under, you're putting most of your dollars into this in the research area right now, and the price is going up. Yet, in spite of this, there are several people who are saying that it may in fact have lower societal cost than fusion power. Fusion power is based on the power like the sun, which involves the combining into a plasma of some low weight materials instead of the heavies. And instead of breaking apart, you combine these light elements such as a tritium, which is a radioactive hydrogen, or deuterium, which is a non-radioactive isotope of hydrogen, or lithium, and then combining, they give off a lot of power. That's like the H-bomb, and it's like the sun. It is a remarkable technological feat, of course, to develop this, because you have to have quite a few million degrees in a plasma, and there aren't too many things that can contain that today. In fact, we don't have anything except what we're using is high gravitational fields, a lot of gauze. And of course, to get this kind of a temperature and maintain for any length of time, it just takes a lot of energy and a lot of know-how. They made considerable progress in this area. And one of the more recent findings that you probably read about is to utilize a laser beam. And it may come about. A lot of people say, but well, let's get fusion then, because it sounds so good. Because they say, well, you won't have any all these radioactive materials from burning the fuel that you have in fission, and you'll have unlimited sources of power, because the energy for this is in seawater, and we got a lot of seawater, because you can get the tritium or the deuterium out of this and the lithium, and we have it for centuries. And it would certainly change the power structure, wouldn't it, if everybody had this kind of fuel and you could work it. But any time that you have neutrons at 14 MeV, which is an energy designation, it's a high energy neutrons, impinging upon the apparatus that makes up a fusion generator, you're going to have a lot of radioactive material showing up, because if you put neutrons into certain materials, depending on their cross-section, you get radioactive material, or you get induced radioactive material. And what are you going to do to that? It's going to be very radioactive. And there are some indications that even at this stage, in some of the estimates being made, that fusion may, in fact, have a higher societal cost than the breeder reactor. Now, coal is a problem, as I mentioned. We got a lot of it, and I think we're going to have to turn to it, and the sooner the better, but we have to, it's going to be very costly, because we have to clean up the system. And also clean up after ourselves after we do it. And this is going to cost you money. And on that basis, at least for the next few decades, just our ordinary fission reactors are a better bet, and they're more economical. And as what I have to say about solar and about fusion is what I've told some of you before. It's like the fellow that says the way to get a baby in a month is to get 9 women pregnant. And it doesn't work that way. It still takes 9 months. And that's the point of the story. To develop solar, you need tremendous resource for development and for research that goes into it. Right now, knowing all we do about nuclear energy, if we're going to have a nuclear reactor operating down here in Wenatchee or somewhere, and we set out today to start the process, it would probably be 10 to 12 years before it's on the line, producing power. And we already have this technology down very well. We're not even in box one on fusion. We're just now really going well, and we started this whole nuclear business back in the 40s. We plowed a lot of money into it. And the point of the story, I think, is to invest more money into, I think we should be investing more into solar research. I think we should give a good deal to fusion. And I think we should try to clean up on the coal and do some research and try to figure out how to use it better. As for our oil supply, we just can't keep doing it the way we're doing it. We have to begin conserving, and we got to begin soon. And I think our children will condemn us for burning it, because it's far more valuable for other utilizations. And it's a great tragedy the way things are going in this regard. It is one of the reasons for my very heavy heart that we don't seem to really get onto things until we're on the brink of catastrophe. And I think we're closer to the brink of catastrophe relative to the hydrocarbon fuels than most people would care to believe. And we still don't have an energy policy in this country.
I read an article where Mr. Jameson, chairman of the board of Exxon.
Yes.
And he reported that in this country, if we did not rely on foreign oil, the children born today, by the time they get to their driver's license at 16, there won't be any oil left in this country.
Yeah. Did you hear that? No. This is the president of Exxon. And it just, there isn't that much left there. And a lot of people say, yeah, but we got the North Slope. Well, boy, all that oil up there, a drop in a bucket. It ain't that much.
The potential of using hydrogen.
Yeah.
The technology of breaking water down into hydrogen oxide, using the hydrogen like you can.
Yes. The comment here relates to a hydrogen economy. This has been proposed seriously by quite a few thinking persons. And in fact, one of the suggestions is to use nuclear power for hydrolysis and for producing hydrogen, because, as you know, we're using hydrogen, oxygen in systems going into space, and seem to use it with some safety there, although it is a very hazardous product. And one of the concerns was that it is exceedingly hazardous, but it is being seriously considered. And you could then produce it in remote areas. You could run it through pipes, or you could put it into tanks and have cars running on hydrogen. When you had a wreck, though, you'd know you had one, I imagine. Unless you make them a little more indestructible than the ones we have now. Now, other people propose, of course, there's an argument. Are we going into a hydrogen economy, or going into a plutonium economy in the next generation? And maybe it could be both. And certainly there can be much done in development of this. Any other comments at this stage? Yes.
I'm not quite as pessimistic as you are, but because we've had several energy transfers in this country in the last century. In the early 1900s, we went from wood to coal as an energy source. throughout the country. In the 30s, we went from coal to oil, and now I hope in the 70s or the 80s, we'll go from oil to nuclear. And I think I concur with your comment that nuclear is not getting a fair shake by anybody. I've had many years' experience in the Navy with it, and they don't have any active that have been operating for many years since 1956. I don't remember a death in the Navy. And it's very safe for the sailors and the operators and the public. My biggest worry, of course, is our politicians who don't seem to want to make up their minds on anything these days. And if they would come up with an energy policy to say, we are going to nuclear power in the next generation, and establish these sites for nuclear power plants, and there will be no environmental protest in the courts, in 10 or 15 years we'll be a nuclear energy society, safely.
No, that's... Did you all hear that? That's a very significant statement. No, that's... Did you all hear that? That's a very significant statement. And I think you'd be pleased to... if you went to the library here, you'd have a report that sounded very much like that by Congressman Mike McCormick, who was on this podium. We invited him up for the meeting of our Scientific Advisory Committee here at Holden. Back on about August the 10th, 13th or something. And he essentially said what you said, and this is what he is promoting.
Did you read the article in the paper for headlines about some scientist who published a paper that 20 miles downstream from every nuclear power plant, the crime rate has gone up by 20% higher than the average? And you know, first of all, the Scientific Society let the guy publish that. It should be disestablished. That guy should be drummed out of the business for writing a paper with the type of evidence he had, and the newspaper should be criticized for publishing garbage.
That's why the UFOs aren't flying around, because these guys are going too.
One of the people, there's several nuts like this around. I've run into them. In fact, I was at a scientific meeting in which Sternglass was. And you see, the misleading part of Sternglass is that they announce, which he is. He's a professor of radiation physics at, I've managed to forget where, but it's in New York, I guess. And probably Buffalo, but don't hold me to that. And I'll just recall some of this for you. In fact, he went on and on, making these crazy statements at one meeting. And these people, they were more or less saying, well, what about this and what about that? And finally, I couldn't stand it longer, and I told him it was an insult to our intelligence, the way he was continuing, and that I had several recommendations for him. One of them was that he ought to take a basic course in radiation biology, since obviously he didn't know anything about it, and that his epidemiology was also deficient, and I'd recommend a basic course in epidemiology. And as for his publication of this of this rot that he was putting out. I was going to suggest Mad Magazine, but I had a bit more respect for that, and I suggested the Policeman's Gazette. And I said that I understood that they were serving beer and sandwiches next door, and I thought that was a much better utilization of our time than listening to this. And with that, the whole assembly quit. They went and had beer and sandwiches, and I think it was to their great fortune. And I had some basis for this, because he was in radiation physics. He's very much given to publicity. His wife is in public relations. And he started out really making a lot of noise. Well, he was opposed, of course, and a lot of people were, to the anti-ballistic missile system. And he announced that this was going to cause the death of all children. And in August of about 60, it was in the 60s, 67 or something, 68 maybe, there was a great big ad taken in the Washington Post, and it says, "We think we have a very important message to tell you," and it was the death of all children. And then it showed a little bit about what he was going to tell in Esquire magazine of August of that year. And then in August of that year, then for a very handsome price, was the article marked urgent on the inside. It was a filler right behind the cover, and it was entitled "The Death of All Children." Now that should be, of course, disturbing to everyone. Not only to the children, it kind of knocks out teachers, and you know, it's a pretty serious thing. So it could cause quite a bit of attention. And his premise went something like this. See, what he does, he hires people, and Nader does the same thing. He hires people who agree with him, and then they say, "Here's what I want you to find out to prove this point." And that isn't good science. And so he gets his students and say, "Get the statistics on this," you see. And so they get the statistics on it, poorly handled, and they drum it all up. And part of his message was this: "I have done some studies on mortality in children, and I noticed that the first sign of an increased infant mortality..." Well, first of all, he drew a chart. And let's see, for you, he drew a chart that showed that back here, and he picked the time, and he said, "Look, at the infant mortality has been falling now for many years, but you notice here in the late 40s, it flattened out. There was an increase then in what he called an increase in infant mortality." It was really a flattening out. And he says, "You know what caused that? That's when the fallout started." And he says, in my results, where did it first show up? He said, in the southern tier of states, because that's where we had the first fallout from the first nuclear blast at El Magordo, New Mexico. But there's something wrong with this. There's several things wrong with it. For one thing, the fallout from El Magordo, New Mexico was not very much, and it didn't go over the southern tier of states. He should have checked it a little better, because it started that way, and then it headed north. It never got to the southern tier of states, where he showed an increase in infant mortality. And the second thing he said was that, and you know what? Everybody knows that fallout is highest where you have the highest rainfall. And that's where the highest infant mortality is. But in checking out the fallout data, we realized that the highest fallout was in some of the dry states, not too far away from the test areas, but in the dry states in New Mexico and all through there, and they had some of the lowest infant mortality. There's another thing. As you analyze it, had he compared the fallout levels, he would have realized that Australia also showed this flattening out of the curve. And Australia by this time hadn't really had any fallout. But other countries that had higher fallout than ours, their mortality continued to fall. Well, it showed a different curve. Well, as one analyzes curves, and if you've got a curve falling like this, really, if you examine his data, he of course selected data. If you would have gone back further than he went, and he hadn't, I'm sure he realized this, but he cut it off because it didn't make his point. But if he had gone back further, he would have seen that the line was coming down like this, and then it went down like this. So he moved the line over here, and he says, look how it's going down, and it's flattening out. Had you looked at the long curve, it sort of went like this and sort of got back to the line. It probably coincided with our finding of sulfa drugs and antibiotics, which caused a decrease in infant mortality, and you can just decrease it so much. And what kind of curve, what this curve say, is that any linear curve like this is misleading. Because on the one hand, if you continue this line out to the left, as he was drawing it, eventually you get to a point in which there was no infant survival. Now we know that isn't true, because you're here. And you'll also, well, if you take it the other way, you'll get to a point when there is no, when there was no infant survival going this way, and no infant mortality going this way, and you and I will never see that, nor will our children. And then he said that strontium was the thing that did it. He says that strontium gets in to the into the ovary, and it causes infant mortality, or it gets into the sperm. And if you examine the radiation dose to the gonads from radioactive strontium, you find out that it's undetectable in the gonads, while very high amounts go to bone. The dose to the gonads is very substantial. For example, from radioactive potassium, which is in us, it causes about 20 millirads a year, and it was there long before the atomic age, and it'll be there forever because it's naturally occurring. And strontium couldn't even find it. And he cited Swedish work to substantiate his claims of low levels amount of strontium causes infant mortality. And as soon as he said Swedish work, as a Norwegian, of course, I became suspicious. And I went back and looked at this work, and the so-called low levels of strontium caused this increase in infant mortality. And what this Swede did, and he was a physicist, not a biologist, and they're a big hazard to us who are in biology, just as Sternglass is, who knows little about biology. And what this fellow did, and a friend of mine in Sweden who's a biologist told him that that's ridiculous to do it that way, but what he did was to inject strontium into the peritoneal cavity of mice. Of course, this isn't the way you get your strontium from fallout. It isn't injected. You eat it or you drink it. But he injected it, and the so-called low levels was one microcurie per gram of mouse. And that was, according to Sternglass, a low dose. Now, if this is a low dose, if I gave you one microcurie of strontium intraperitoneally per gram of body weight, it would not be consistent with living out the year. I do not consider that a low dose, nor does anybody else that knows anything about it. Now, one also knows, if he knows anything at all about biology, if you inject something into the peritoneal cavity or into the abdominal cavity, you know that the gonads are in the inguinal canal, and you know that fluid will settle into the inguinal canal. And the gonads of a mouse are not that big. And if you submerge the gonads of a mouse in a strontium solution, even though it's a beta emitter and doesn't penetrate very much, it's like going to sleep with an X-ray machine on in your bed. And that too is not a recommended policy. It will have an effect on your gonads, I can assure you. And so it's a ridiculous experiment. And that is one reason why I do not believe Sternglass. Now, he got a big play in this country. And I remember I was called as one of the people to inform the press at the International News Office outside of the UN. Oh, that's many years ago now. And they were, of course, uptight about Sternglass. But I found out that most of the Europeans hadn't fallen for it. They knew he was a charlatan. It's ridiculous stuff. But he got headlines here, and he's still getting headlines here. He shows up at all the hearings and puts out this crap. I know when he was visiting Richmond, I was there, and my associate, Dr. Goldman, was there. We wanted to appear on the radio with him, but he did not wish to appear on the radio with us. And and also in these hearings, he's always a little more subdued when my associate Goldman is there, who's forgotten more than Sternglass ever knew. It's really a sad thing, because they're false prophets, and it's costing you a lot. Yes?
Seems like a problem.
Yes, I think that summarizes the problem very well. In any democracy such as ours, right today, I imagine if we said no more cars out of Detroit, our transportation industry is what, 25%, huh, of our employment? And if you have that kind of unemployment, there will be no doubt a change in government. That's the problem we face. You cannot make a quick switch and have a continuation of our present form of government. And that concerns the politician very deeply, and many people do not understand that. Yes?
It seems like we couldn't switch to an energy completely different from now, too, because we don't know if we switch to solar, we don't know if that's the best energy source yet, because of the cost of solar cell housing and stuff. Or if we raise the fusion, we have to develop a breaking point in it. So we really can't say we have to go into fusion or any other source, because we don't know which one's better yet.
Yeah, we're in the transition stage, as we always are, as you pointed out, in energy. It's a stepwise thing, and we have not perhaps committed our resources wisely up till now. We probably haven't had an enlightened energy policy. We certainly haven't been economizing on our energy use. I thought I had some hope there for a while when we slowed down and we cut out Sunday driving and started to change our lifestyle, and there was really some hope for a while. But I know I despair a bit, and you are fortunately, hopefully, more optimistic enough, you're right, than I. But until we get to another real crisis, we may not be doing much about it. And while other people are paying $1.50 a gallon for gasoline, we are still getting it for 64 cents a gallon. Yes?
Why do water and
water power? Yes. Yes, the question is, why not water power? It looks like a clean source. And I'll tell you what I told the Swedes. They have a little bit of potential of water power yet to develop. But it's only a drop in the bucket. It would make hardly any impact on us. And the Swedes the same way. And today, if you're going to build a dam in Sweden, They hire a bunch of Laplanders or Norwegians to lay them down in front of the of the bulldozers and keep them from doing it. And in this country, we could go ahead and we could dam up Hell's Canyon and the Grand Canyon of the Colorado, and you'd get a few million megawatts, but it ain't that much, and people aren't going to let you do it. And I think that is too also fortunate. What the amount of water power is important to take the peak off, and that's probably what it will be utilized for. And what we'll be doing is especially in areas where you can do it, you'll utilize the water power and then to knock off the peak load, and then during low periods of utilization, you'll pump the water back up in the dam and run it out again to knock off the peak. But it's again pretty much a drop in the bucket, although it is of some significance to Norway and also to us here in the state of Washington. It's quite significant, but it's again quite costly because it keeps filling up behind the dam, silting in and silting in, and so its life is somewhat limited, I guess.
I saw a television program which showed a couple of men from England who were doing experiments with utilizing the tide.
Yes.
And I meant not the rivers, but the power to get from the ocean.
Yes. Yes, there are a few places in the world, and they are not very many, that might be utilizable for harnessing tides. There is quite a demonstration one, and the ones that people always refer to is one in France. It's quite a large project, but it's exceedingly expensive, and they are not economically feasible in most instances at this time, and there aren't enough of them that will make much of an impact. Yeah, yeah. There is some work now on wave action. I don't know if there's enough work to on it for me to make a judgment. Maybe there's somebody here that knows.
Years away.
Years away. What I told the Swedes was, you Swedes, you got a problem. You don't have any oil. And the Norwegians, if you think you're going to get it cheaper than you get it from the Arab, you got another yes coming. They'll probably charge you a buck more in barrels. You don't have any coal. You can't be cutting down all your trees because that ain't going to do it for you. And you can go to solar, except the sun doesn't shine here very much. And you've about done in on your water farm. Your tides aren't going to do you that much good. You don't have any hot rocks underground like geothermal, which we're investigating and which may be a source of some power in the West. You know, I don't know where you're going. There's only one way you can go. You have uranium, and they have. And you have these deep rock-hewn caves, and they're worried about waste products. And the amount of high-level waste that they'll have each year is probably, I could probably put my arms, you know. You know, something like this, they put it in the cave, you know, and but they're fighting the feeling. That's not to say it's not without hazard. Nothing is without hazard.
That uranium 235 and UNAP is not scared?
Yes, that's a very important problem. That's why I limited mine for the next few decades. And there again, it's a matter of economy. The amount of relatively economical uranium is somewhat limited. I don't know if we know the full resource. There's a lot of low grade, which would be more expensive to extract, but it is limited in its amount. But unlike coal and oil, we don't know any other use for it. Yes?
Does the breeder reactor
Yes.
How about that storage?
Yes. The storage problem has caused many people a lot of problems. I don't know, it doesn't bug me so much. And many years ago, it was in the 50s, my neighbor developed a method of calcining waste where you reduce the volume down to hard pellets. If we went into nuclear energy full blow now, imagine the contribution of each one of you in high-level waste would be about the size of an aspirin tablet per year. I think something like that. And how do you store it? The proposal I like, I think salt mines are still a very good possibility. That they still exist after many millennia would indicate that there isn't much water there, otherwise there wouldn't be salt mines. Unfortunately, the selection of the area in Kansas as the first trial was a poor choice because it had holes in it and there were some problems with it. I still think that's a potential, but the amount that we have isn't that much. Over the next couple of decades, we can develop an improved technology for it. The proposal by Hanford Laboratories and other places is that we can put them above ground in remote places, in almost indestructible areas, and where you can also get at it if you have to, but it will be protected and guarded. And it doesn't really represent, that I see, any hazard in this kind of a remote storage. It also has the advantage that it can be readily available because as technology develops, maybe some of these that we've already found are potential sources for utilization in various endeavors. For example, we're running certain remote stations now in the Arctic, weather stations under the ocean with isotopes. No moving parts. It's a direct thermal electrical conversion. And it's good for a long time. Yes?
What about the waste heat that you get from the reactor?
The what? The waste heat?
Yeah.
Yes. One of the contaminations of any plant, whether it's coal, oil, or nuclear, is waste heat. And this is of great concern to a lot of people. There is some more because it's, at this stage, somewhat less efficient from nuclear versus coal, although the efficiencies are increasing. The heat is dissipated, and in some areas, there have been many proposals. If you go to Minnesota or other Siberian places, like Siberian-like places, you could stand some of that heat during a great significant part of the year. There have been some proposals that you can heat up irrigation water, and there have been some studies on this, to increase the productivity of the land. Another proposal was that they were also spraying it or using it on the streets to keep them thawed out. It depends on where you're located. But it does represent a problem. However, I point out that it isn't all bane and no boo. In fact, if we went to nuclear plants out on the water, say in the marine environment, you'd find out that that's where the people would go to fish. And because it's warmer there, the fish are attracted by it. And it may change the biota somewhat, but possibly to a more productive area, because fish grow more rapidly when the water is warmer. In some other situations, it may produce or increase the incidence of disease in a given type of animal. There have been quite a few studies on this. For example, the Columbia was slightly warmed by the presence of the nuclear plants at Hanford Atomic Product Operation, where at one time there were many large power reactors, and they were the ones who discharged the water into the Columbia. But they studied the biota of that. They were studying the ecology there before most people knew what ecology was. And they studied, and they followed how many salmon nests and the productivity of that whole river from the time they started the plant, and they really couldn't show any effect.
Warm water is a very valuable commodity.
Oh, yes. It can be very valuable commodity.